here and try it. I'll shove that badge and gun up your fat ass. Fuck you. I know you have sources and intelligence material to my case. The CIA has intelligence and they send it to you. You have CIA officers in your shop working for you. Why not share some of what you have? That would generate link analysis, better requirements, and maybe more relevant, more exact intelligence. Can't do that. Can't undermine the prosecution. You need to support me. We are supporting you, you dumb shit. Not enough. John, you will never have enough. That's right, now you get it. You really are a pain in the ass. Yes, I am. Come to New York and I'll buy you a steak. Just bring something useful with you. Only if you give me something. Yeah, good steak. Goodbye, John. The FBI had legal attachés assigned mostly to pleasant European cities where they could collaborate with Western-oriented law enforcement agencies. Watson and Rowlands recognized the need for expansion into other areas. I encouraged this, explaining that increasingly our best intelligence and best evidence came from our allies in the Middle East and Africa. In the wake of the 1998 bombings, the Kenyan and Tanzanian services demonstrated that. The FBI sought greater partnerships with foreign law enforcement, but also wanted to run its own sources abroad, sometimes clandestinely, without regard to tradecraft. The FBI routinely used open phone lines. Moreover, the Bureau maintained that if a source supported an ongoing criminal case, it was not an intelligence operation, so it did not require any coordination with anybody. This posed problems, and I spent considerable time slogging through this thick and muddy turf. There were also gaps with our overseas partners. Mike and I discovered this during a trip to Israel in 1999. Mike and I offered them an update on the East Africa investigations and our assessment of the growing Al-Qaeda threat, including in the Levant. Our Israeli interlocutors shrugged off our warnings about AQ. Israeli military intelligence stressed the Hezbollah threat, which was real enough, as Mike and I saw when we toured the northern border with Lebanon. Israel's Shin Bet, their internal service, stressed Hamas. Neither of them considered AQ worthy of serious discussion. The British were good, but not as good as they thought or acted. One issue was their failure to realize the growing radical threat within their own borders. I lost count of the times the British lectured me on their counterterrorism expertise, given all their success in Northern Ireland. Mike and I, supported by the FBI, NYC Field Office, and CTC, found the British intent on acquiring intelligence and lecturing us on how to conduct operations, rather than sharing intelligence and advancing joint efforts. I told Mike that the British had a course designed to maximize their relationship with the Americans and used case studies from World Wars I and II on how their influence operations worked, even at the White House. I told Mike that I usually preferred working with Africans, Arabs, Latinos, and Asians anyway. They seemed more interesting, more elemental, and often more cooperative. And the food was better. Mike and others at the Bureau taught me more than I could have imagined, and not just about law enforcement, but also about my own agency. From the FBI perspective, the CIA was arrogant, sometimes disdainful. CIA officers often failed to grasp the value of evidence. One COS, having obtained valuable material in one case from a local liaison service, threw the package into a safe where it sat for months. A visiting analyst discovered it and forwarded a copy to the FBI. The intelligence had already been reported. The intelligence was valuable, but the evidence was useless because there was no clear, documented chain of custody. Another COS worked to undermine the assignment of an FBI legal attaché to his country of assignment, fearing competition, instead of embracing another player on the team. Another COS criticized the FBI to foreign liaison, which prompted my sharp intervention. Never ever should one U.S. government agency play off another against a foreign government. I witnessed many examples of this, including foreign services manipulating CIA and FBI rivalry to their advantage. The British and Israelis routinely worked that angle. The FBI taught me many things and introduced me to the interagency process. I often represented the FBI at the National Security Council, NCS, Counterterrorist Security Group, CSG, an assemblage of executives from the U.S. counterterrorism community. The CSG coordinated and executed the policies set by the NSC. Richard Clark, the president's counterterrorism advisor, chaired the CSG. He understood the threat and demanded greater interagency cooperation. He browbeat anybody who would let him and seemed to engender resentment unnecessarily. Maybe he figured the system only responded to brute force. Given the larger ignorance of the threat and the bureaucratic resistance to change, I shared his frustration. Most of all, the FBI tour informed me about my country as seen through the eyes of law enforcement and the larger political system. The enduring power of the law and the respect it garnered was awesome. The law enforcement community, from the FBI to the local police force, depended on civil society. So did the intelligence community. But I worried about the gap between the intelligence community and civil society. I also was concerned about the rigidity of our national security structure and the resistance to change. This was especially true regarding intelligence capabilities in the homeland. Within our borders, we were blind. Would we adapt fast enough? Where would we be hit again? Could we avoid a terrorist catastrophe on American soil? After almost a year at the FBI, I told Rowlands that I was returning to CTC. I would serve as the deputy for incoming CTC Chief Kofor Black. I explained that I would be responsible for all of the CIA's CT operations. Rowlands was not happy, since he expected to have me for at least another year. I explained my future value to him and the broader CT mission. I thanked him. He and the FBI had treated me fairly. During my tenure, most FBI colleagues accepted me. Many instructed me while listening to my persistent advice, both critical and encouraging. They gave me a good send-off, complete with my framed FBI credentials, which I proudly display today. They also presented me with a gag FBI wanted poster, with the following charges just above my grainy photo: conspiracy to destroy bureaucracy and murder of outdated ideas and methods. The poster noted my occupation as agitator, my hair from buzz to bush, and my eyes crazed. Accurate cautionary notes: subject to fits of rage, and never under any circumstances ask the same questions twice when an answer has already been provided. The reward for my capture? 5 million Pakistani rupees. Chapter 8. The Counterterrorism Center. Necessity is the mother of taking chances. Mark Twain, Roughing It. By the late 1990s, after more than 10 years of existence, the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, CTC, was the epicenter of U.S. counterterrorist operations, including not only intelligence collection, but also a heavy dose of covert action. From my training and from my work in Africa, where the United States and Soviet Union fought many of the hot battles of the Cold War, I had gained experience in covert action, but I was not an expert, nor was I an information operations officer or a paramilitary officer. By the summer of 1999, I had learned more about counterterrorism policy at the FBI than at the CIA. My knowledge of intelligence, law enforcement, and covert action in counterterrorism had grown, particularly from an interagency perspective. The demands at CTC would be more operational, however, particularly at the nexus of intelligence and covert action. In preparation for my new assignment, I intensified my study of the modern history of terrorism, covert action, and the CTC. During the 1970s, Palestinian leftist groups, supported by the Libyans, Soviets, and some Warsaw Pact countries, had proven viciously lethal. They had hijacked airplanes, attacked airports, and killed hundreds. In some cases, there was collusion with radical European groups and the Japanese Red Army. They kidnapped and killed European industrialists and politicians. Many U.S. citizens also died at the hands of these terrorists. After the 1979 Iranian Revolution, Tehran began exporting terrorism through its operatives and proxies, such as Hezbollah. In April 1983, Hezbollah bombed the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, killing 60 people. This attack took a heavy toll on the CIA station, almost wiping out the staff. One of the few survivors, a classmate of mine,